Olympics. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In 1970, Henry Morrow, a black Vietnam War veteran, was murdered in Oxford, North Carolina. The acquittal by an all-white jury of the white men alleged to have murdered him led to arson and violence and to an 18-month boycott of white businesses in that mostly segregated town. Benjamin Chavis, already a civil rights worker, led the boycott, which serves as the backdrop for the book and the film Blood Done Sign My Name. As tumultuous as those events were, they are just a small portion of Benjamin Chavis's biography, who in 1971 was sentenced to 34 years in prison as a member of the so-called Wilmington Ten. The conviction was later overturned, and Chavis went on to become the youngest leader of the NAACP and an organizer of the Million Man March. Again, those accomplishments are but a small part of his biography and his contributions to the equality movement. Dr. Benjamin Chavis is a UNC Charlotte alumnus and will be back on campus later this week as part of the Alumni Association's Celebrating African American Legacies slate of events and for the screening of the film Blood Done Sign My Name. And in advance of that visit, he joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike. It's a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to being back in Charlotte, North Carolina this week.
Well, nice to have you with us this morning. As I said, you're a native of, I think I said, you're a native of Oxford, North Carolina, and I was going to say that you began your work for civil rights in 1963 as a worker for Dr. Martin Luther King, but in truth, you actually began your work in that area, I guess almost unbeknownst to you, at the age of 12 when you became the first African-American to get a library card from the public library in your hometown. What year was that, and how did that happen?
That was in the early 1960s. I think it was 1961. I was born in 1948. And, you know, Oxford, North Carolina, tobacco plantation town. It's my hometown. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Granville County. And the Chavis family has been in that county since 1740. My great-great-great-grandfather, the Reverend John Chavis, was the first African-American to attend Princeton University and the first African-American to be ordained as a Presbyterian minister. He was also from Oxford and Granville County. So the roots of the Chavis family go very, very deep into the evolution of North Carolina history, even when it was one of the 13 colonies.
But why did they give you a library card in the early 1960s? This is pre-Civil Rights Act, pre the March on Washington. How did that happen?
Well, I wanted to read. The library in Oxford was segregated for colored children. I went to what was called the North Carolina Colored School System. As you know, back in the 1950s, early 1960s, there were three school systems in North Carolina, particularly Eastern North Carolina. One for whites, one for blacks, which they called a colored school system, and one for Indians. They didn't, you know, so as poor as Granville County was, they maintained three separate and unequal school systems. So one day walking home from school, I knew my parents had paid taxes. They had just built this brand new library, the Thornton Library in Oxford. And I saw these beautiful books through the window. And I said, look, you know, it's just not right for me not to be able to read this book. So I walked in. Some of my classmates stayed outside and watched because they knew that the lady would probably call the cops, which she did. And my mother and father were school teachers at that time, and they called my parents. One of the proudest days of my life, instead of my parents spanking me for breaking what was then the law, they stood with me, and we integrated the library that day. And then all my friends, for the first time, were able to read a book with both covers on it.
But how? I still don't understand how it happened. Given the prevailing mores of the day and the stubbornness.
Well, I grew up in the church. You know, at 10 years old, 11 years old, 12 years old, I had already joined the youth chapter of the NAACP. Mm-hmm. And I was an acolyte at St. Cyprian's Church. I carried the cross every Sunday, and I listened to the preacher talk about how all people were created in the image of God, and I believed that. And I felt it was wrong. Even as an adolescent, I knew something was wrong. And quite frankly, Mike, I felt that maybe the older generation was too tolerant. And my generation, it was time for us to stand up, speak out. But before you do something for other people, you got to do something for yourself. I needed that book.
But given the intransigence of the white community, particularly back then, in the very early 1960s, what provoked them or what led them to say, okay, we'll relent in your case, give you a card, and allow you into this library?
Well, it wasn't easy, you know, but by the time the library, who was elderly, called the police, a big crowd was standing outside looking out the window. And keep in mind, I wasn't doing something violent. I wasn't doing something destructive. Here's at 11, 12 years old, I'm pleading to have the right to get a book out of the public library, where public libraries built with public dollars. You know, so I wasn't, in my mind, doing something that would provoke, a white supremacist backlash from the Ku Klux Klan. I never expected that. So, sometimes I found out at an early age, an injustice will remain an injustice, Mike, until you stand up to it. So I felt so good that night. I made me out a list that night because, you know, a little bit of freedom is not sufficient. The dime store, the movies, the swimming pool, everything was segregated in my town. Mm-hmm. And I grew up with this not only knowledge, but an aspiration, not just, and keep in mind, I didn't want a book just for myself. I wanted a book for all my classmates. And I wanted black students and white students and Native American students to be able to go to school together and learn together and make Oxford, my hometown, a better place.
Soon thereafter, you went to work as a youth coordinator, statewide youth coordinator for Dr. Martin Luther King, and you have been described as one of Dr. King's assistants. What did that job entail?
I was this Golden Freaks, who was the statewide field secretary for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, actually asked me to come to work at the statewide Southern Christian Leadership Conference youth coordinator. And in that capacity, Golden introduced me to Dr. King. Dr. King was the national leader of SCLC. And, I was so privileged as a youngster to be able to be a youth organizer. Young people were very excited. The sit-in movement started in Greensboro in the early 1960s. And even though I was in high school, I felt a part of that movement. And I was the editor of my high school newspaper, Merrill Potter High School Gazette. I was writing editorials about civil rights, about SCLC, about Martin Luther King, and to have the privilege to work for him, I was proud. I became a better student in school. I studied hard. You know, I didn't shortcut. I wanted to show my parents I could make good grades and be in the movement and work for Dr. King at the same time. It helped me to be a better student and, I believe, a better person. Working with Martin Luther King Jr. was probably a critical turning point in my life.
Given the distance that we have now from those turbulent days of the 1960s and the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War protests, there are a lot of people out there who don't remember that period and who did not live through that period. They weren't alive yet, so they're what they know of it is really ancient history to them. And what we do remember most vividly about that period are the things that happened in the Deep South, in Selma and places like that. Not so much what happened in North Carolina. Were the fire hoses and the angry police, the police brutality and the lynchings and the church bombings, was that an aberration that happened only in the Deep South? Or was that danger present all the time?
North Carolina, because it was North Carolina, was always considered a quote-unquote progressive southern state, but you have to put that in context. North Carolina also had lynchings. North Carolina also had dogs, plow hoses. But North Carolina, had a way of making the incidents seem isolated. But down in the Deep South, they were more commonplace. But North Carolina had its share of repression, had its share, certainly, of discrimination, and that's why. Why would North Carolina be the first state where students had sit-ins? The sit-in movement started in Greensboro. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons is because college students, North Carolina has a number of HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, which I support wholeheartedly. Even today, we still need those universities. College students felt it was an indignity not to be able to sit at a restaurant, a Woolworth, in that case in Greensboro. We had Rose's in my hometown in Oxford, but all of the dime stores. In Durham, it was also similar Woolworths. So it was across the state. While a lot of the attention focused on Selma, Montgomery, and other places where there was just so much violence, it was a southern-wide evolution of consciousness. I think when young people become aware that they can make a change, and that is why by the time I became a student at UNC at Charlotte, you know, I was not only for civil rights, but I was opposed to the Vietnam War. We did things on UNCC's campus that I thought had much significance, and I'm so pleased to be able to be invited back to the campus so they can see blood and sign their name. So all of, and my point, Mike, is that all these things are connected. You know, what happened in Mississippi was connected to what was going on in Charlotte, or what was going on in Oxford, or what was going on in Southern Virginia. I was just in Southern Virginia several weeks ago for the Martin Luther King celebration. And people there in Danville, Virginia, was also remembering how separated things were. Now, we've come a long way. We have an African-American as a president of the United States today in 2014. So I've seen how far we've come, Mike, firsthand over the last 50, 60 years.
I want to get into that a little bit later on, but let's, since you brought it up, let's talk about it a little bit right now. And since you knew Dr. King, what do you think his take would be on where we are today?
I think Dr. King would, on the one hand, be celebratory that we've made so much progress, but on the other hand, in the wake of Trayvon Martin case, in the wake of the Jordan case that just happened this past weekend, mm-hmm. In the wake of what's going on in Raleigh, in North Carolina, it has become almost a Mississippi when it comes to voting rights, suppression of voting rights. The legislature is enacting these archaic and arcane measures to take away people's rights. The quality of life in North Carolina should be one of the best quality of life in the southern state, but it's not, because of division, because of... So I would say that Dr. King would recognize the progress, Mike, that was made, but he would also be vigilant. He would be summoning a new round of civil rights workers, civil rights leaders. I'm so pleased with the Reverend Dr. William Barber. Reverend Barber's movement that he's organizing. Dr. Barber is the statewide president of the NAACP. I'm so pleased of what they're doing with their Moral Monday marches, and they just had tens of thousands of people in Raleigh a week or so ago. So I think the indication is that the civil rights movement is still alive. And I tweeted earlier this week, the civil rights movement is needed more in 2014 than we needed it in 1960 or 1950.
Really? More?
Yes. More.
Given all the...
reason why, because the demographics have changed, Mike. You know, we're much more, in terms of demographics, pluralistic society, but we don't have pluralistic justice. We don't have equality. There's too much income inequality. There's too much racial inequality. You know, people are not doing enough in terms of having a multicultural, multilingual understanding where we can appreciate the dignity and the worth of every human being without belittling people because of their race or because of their religion or because of their ethnicity. I think we are all because of their sexual preference. And, you know, North Carolina still struggles with that. And I think that it is movements like the civil rights movement, like the women's movement, the gay rights movement, like all these movements are striving for a sense of equality and equal justice.
We're going to come back and talk more about the need for civil rights today as we go through this hour of conversation with Dr. Benjamin Chavis, a civil rights activist, organizer of the Million Man March, and a UNC Charlotte alumnus who'll be back in town this week, as a matter of fact, for Blood Done Sign My Name, the film. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Evita March 4th through 9th. Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical comes to Belk Theater, direct from Broadway. Tickets available at blumenthalarts.org. And Cannon School, where students and teachers go beyond to embrace a lifelong love of learning, hosting an upper school information session tomorrow at 10 a.m. Details at cannonschool.org. Journalist Soledad O'Brien began a conversation on race race on her CNN series Black in America, and now she's taking that conversation on the road. She's coming to Charlotte, and as a person of mixed race, she's faced a lot of complicated questions about her lineage, and she will join us to answer more in the first half of our show tomorrow. And then documentarian Steve Crump talks about his four-part film looking at the turbulent civil rights events of 1963. That's all tomorrow morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Comcast begins a full court press in Washington to get approval for its proposed takeover of Time Warner Cable. What a merger of the nation's two largest cable companies could mean for consumers, content, and the Internet.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Benjamin Chavis is our guest today. He'll be in town on Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock for a screening and to talk about Blood Done Sign My Name. It's a film that deals with what happened in Oxford, North Carolina, and he's a character in the film. That'll be going on at the UNCC Student Union. We have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. Before we talk about Oxford, let's talk about UNC Charlotte for just a couple of seconds, because in between 1963, when you were working with Dr. King, and 1970, when you organized the Oxford, North Carolina boycott, you attended UNC Charlotte, became active in promoting activities of African American students there, and in 1969 presented 10 demands to the university administration. What were those demands? What prompted them? How were they received?
Right. Keep in mind the 10 demands that we presented to the University of North Carolina Charlotte was a little less than 12 months after Dr. King was assassinated in April 4th, 1968. Just want to put everything in context. Mm-hmm. And of course, when Dr. King was killed in April, Robert Kennedy was killed in June of 1968. I was also a coordinator for Robert Kennedy's presidential campaign. And then in November of 68, Richard Nixon got elected as president. So 1969 was a very stressful, polarizing year for African-American college students, as I was at the time. And certainly we thought it was time for a great university emerging in the Queen City, University of North Carolina, Charlotte, to focus on having an African a studies program, an African-American studies program, a black study. I was the president of the Black Student Union at the time at UNCC, as well as Students for Action, which was an integrated group of black and white students. And we pushed these demands, one for a black studies program. We wanted more black faculty on UNCC's campus, more black administrators, more access for enrollment. Mike, I was a chemistry student at UNC at Charlotte, and I was the first black student to graduate from Charlotte in the chemistry department. But I remember when I first arrived at UNCC's campus in late 1966, early 1967, I was only one of eight black students on the whole campus.
So you didn't have a lot of population heft. There weren't a lot of students behind you. You kind of accomplished this with a small number of people.
There were some good progressive white students who joined with us. Mike Carmichael and many others, you know, joined the Black Student Union. You know, it was the Black Student Union. We had some white members.
Okay. After you graduated from UNC Charlotte, you went back to Oxford to teach at Mary Potter High School.
It was Mary Potter High School, my high school alma mater, and I was so pleased to get a job there. And it was while I was teaching that my cousin Henry Morrow was killed by the Teal family. Right. And of course, I wanted my students at Mary Potter High School to not only understand what had happened, but understand that they needed to participate in helping prevent these kind of things. So I took my whole class to the courtroom during the trial, not knowing that when I walked my class out of Mary Potter High School, the whole school came with me. And, of course, that's a scene in Blood Done Sign My Name. I'm really thankful to Tim Tyson, Dr. Tim Tyson, a Duke University professor, who did his dissertation, PhD dissertation, on Oxford, and which later became a book entitled Blood Done Sign My Name, and now that's a movie. And And I'm so pleased that this movie has been successful across the country, and we're going to have a special screening at UNC at Charlotte on this coming Wednesday.
Did you, Nate Parker is the actor who plays you in that movie. Did you consult with him?
Did a great job. Nate Parker is an outstanding young actor. And, in fact, I told Nate, I said, man, you played me so well. It was like watching myself on the screen. They really did a great job. It was a well-written screenplay. And the actors that were chosen were right on. And I thank Jeb Stuart, the director of the movie, for doing such a great job. And Jeb Stuart, you need to know, the director of the movie, is an ancestor of the Confederate General Stuart, also from North Carolina. So there were a lot of historical convergences. And this is a true story from Oxford, North Carolina, 1970. The necessary to do an economic boycott, which actually changed Oxford forever after 18 months. Blacks and whites started to get along in Oxford and are getting along today as a result of what happened. It's so tragic that sometimes, someone has to lose their life in order to open doors of justice and equality for others. And that's why I remind young people today not to take civil rights for granted, not to take voting rights for granted, not to take the opportunities to get health care for granted. There's so much that we need to keep pushing for to make sure that everybody has an equal chance at life, and we can improve the quality of life for all of God's people, not some of God's people, but all of God's people.
Soon after the events of Oxford, you became involved in activities in Wilmington and became part of what is now known as the Wilmington 10. What was happening in Wilmington as a result of the integrating of the schools there? I know it wasn't going well. And as part of their Commission for Racial Justice, the United Church of Christ sent you there to try and calm the situation. What was the situation before you arrived?
Well, thank you. But keep in mind, after the situation in Oxford, I led a march from Oxford to Raleigh. And on that march, the leaders of the United Church of Christ Commission for Racial Justice actually offered me a job. And I later joined the United Church of Christ, became a minister of the United Church of Christ. And the United Church of Christ Commission for Racial Justice sent me to Wilmington in February of 1971 to respond to pleas for help from the African-American community who were crying out because of the injustice of how the schools were being desegregated. Keep in mind, there was resistance to school integration in Wilmington. In fact, the NAACP had to file a federal suit to get the schools desegregated in New Hanover County and Wilmington. And so it was a court order desegregation, and there was violent resistance to school integration. That's why I was sent to Wilmington. It was in the context of resistance to school integration that led to the riot in Wilmington. In fact, we were the victims of the riot. People were shooting at us because we were trying to integrate the schools, and yet the state of North Carolina indicted me and nine other people. We became known as the Wilmington 10. 10 of us were sentenced in 1972 to 282 years in prison. I had the longest sentence, the 34-year sentence.
Well, let's back up.
When I talk about my relationship with the state of North Carolina, it is long-standing, mm-hmm. not only for me, but my family. I love North Carolina. People ask me, why do you want to come back to North Carolina after all this happened? Because I love the state, I love the people, and I intend to continue to work in my home state for freedom, justice, and equality for all people.
Well, let's back up, because a lot of people don't remember this whole incident in Wilmington. I know that when you went to Wilmington, I'm told at least, that you preached nonviolence to the students there. You met regularly.
That's correct.
You met regularly with a group of them at Gregory Congregational Church, which was across the street from a place called Mike's Grocery. It's a white-owned business which was firebombed in 1971. And evidently, and I've read several accounts of this, and they're a little foggy, you were meeting at the church at the time. Firefighters claim they were fired upon when they came to put out the fire at Mike's Grocery, fired upon by snipers who were on the roof of the church. The neighborhood erupted in a riot. That riot lasted for several days. The governor sent the National Guard. It ended up with your arrest and the arrest of nine others. I think you were 24 years old at the time. Most of the others were in their teens. You were sentenced, to 34 years in prison. You served four and then had your conviction overturned. Even if you'd been guilty, isn't 34 years a long sentence for setting a fire in which no one died?
Well, we were completely innocent, Mike.
Well, I know that.
First, I just want to just correct something. Mike's grocery store, yes, was diagonally across the block from where Greater Congregational United Church of Christ was located. But what people don't tell you is that African-American family was living over the top of Mike's grocery. There was a residence. It wasn't just a grocery store. And nobody in their right mind would have set that store on fire. That's what I'm saying. You know, people in the neighborhood believe that the owner's father set it on fire for insurance. But nobody from the church had anything to do with burning down Mike's grocery. And the state knew it. Mike, I think it's really important for your listeners to understand that the reason why the case of the Wilmington 10 was eventually overthrown, it took us 10 years of litigation. Yes, I served 4.5 years in prison, but it was 10 years of litigation until we could overturn the case in December of 1980. But we were the victims of prosecutorial misconduct, according to the federal courts. Now, what does that mean? That means we were framed up. The prosecutor knew that we were innocent, but prosecuted us anyway because they were angry at these young student leaders. You have to understand, I was a civil rights activist. I was well known. But how did they choose the other members of the Wilmington 10? It wasn't because they did anything wrong. It was because they were student leaders. That's how they were singled out. And they were the people who had prosecutorial authority in Wilmington at the time, Jay Stroud and others. I think he lives over in Gastonia, there near Charlotte, had a vindictive attitude toward us for fighting for equality and equal access to education. Let me tell you something that's not properly known. You know Michael Jordan, the great basketball player from Wilmington?
Sure.
He's from Wilmington. He was in junior high school at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of the young people we were fighting for that had the right to eventually go to the University of North Carolina and now become one of the world's greatest basketball players. So you know, a lot of times when people read the details of the Wilmington 10 case, they think it's a simple thing. Well, did these guys commit arson or not? No, we did not commit arson. We didn't do anything. But I was a disciple of Dr. King still in 1971 and 72 during the whole incident. I was preaching nonviolence. But the state framed us up, and I'm so thankful to the Honorable Beverly Perdue. 40 years later, Mike, the Honorable Beverly Perdue, one of the greatest governors in North Carolina has ever had, issued a pardon of innocence to the Wilmington 10. And that's after an extensive investigation. You just don't get a pardon of innocence like that. It takes a long, protracted investigation. And I'm thankful to Governor Perdue for not only issuing a pardon of innocence to the Wilmington 10, but finally clearing our names, clearing our records. So that, and unfortunately, four members of the Wilmington 10 died before even knowing that they would get a pardon of innocence.
That happened in 2012, and each of you received, I'm told, $50,000 for each year of incarceration. Does that make up for
it? Well, that's what we awarded, but, you know, we had to pay legal fees, so we had to pay legal fees out of that. So
well,
I don't want to imagine, we just walked away with, you know, a lot of cash. The truth of the matter is, how can you pay somebody for 40 years of your life that has been injured, 40 years of your life where a cloud has been placed over your head, an unjust allegation for 40 years.
Yeah.
It affected me. It affected my co-defendants. It affected our families. It affected my children. It affected my grandchildren.
Well, I was going to ask you if you felt that justice has been served by that pardon, but I think I've just gotten my answer to the question.
Well, you know, again, I'm so grateful and thankful to the Honorable Governor Perdue for issuing the pardon of innocence. That served in a major way to relieve and to give a perfect justice. You know what I mean by perfect justice? Not total justice, perfect justice. A perfect victory to the members of the Wilmington 10. We ultimately triumphed. There was a triumphant celebration in Wilmington after the issue of the pardon of innocence. So we're very grateful and thankful. But as I look back now, Mike, over the 40, 50 years, that's why I said at the beginning of the program, I think today there's more reasons to have the civil rights movement today than ever before. But the problem is people are a little less conscious. People's eyes are a little less perceptive. I try to make sure that young people know today that each generation has to rise to its own occasion. The issues are different than they were 50 years ago. I mentioned the Trayvon Martin case, the Jordan case. And then there are cases right there in Charlotte where a young man went begging for help and was shot by the Charlotte police because they thought he was in the wrong neighborhood at the wrong time and shot all those times. Now I understand the grand jury has reindicted the local. So there are issues that are still prevalent today. Have we made progress in 50 years? Absolutely. We've made a lot of progress. But do we still have a ways to go? Absolutely. We still don't have a society where there is 100% equal justice, where there's 100% racial justice for everybody. There's still too much discrimination, and we should always be vigilant. And I hope when people see the film on this Wednesday at UNC at Charlotte, Blood Didn't Sign My Name, they will not only see it as a historical film, but they will see it as a film that has contemporary application to 2014.
You know, after Barack Obama's first election, many hoped that we had entered a post-racial period in America. And now that he's been in office for, 6 years, there are those who say that perhaps his election has exacerbated a problem that had been put on the back burner for a while. How do you see it?
Oh, no, I'm a strong supporter of President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama. I know them. I knew them in Chicago. I knew President Obama when he was a state senator in Illinois. We did environmental justice work together in Southside Chicago, actually. So I thought it was a great triumph. And again, if Dr. King were alive, he would say, my dream has partially been fulfilled with the election of President Barack Obama. So, but I would caution those, no, this is not a post-racial society. This is not a post-civil rights society. I've heard people say that also. And it's certainly not a post-racism society. We still have these problems. But I think in order to make more progress, you have to properly assess where you are. And the truth of the matter is we have made tremendous strides forward. And I don't want anyone, even in North Carolina, we've made tremendous strides forward. And one of the reasons why the Republicans got back into the state legislature and the McCrory now, former Charlotte mayor, now who's the governor, one of the reasons why people are demonstrating again is because they're going in the wrong direction. Rather than going forward, they seem to be going backwards. I want the whole South, not just North Carolina, but all of the whole country should be going forward toward more racial equality, not less. We should be going forward toward more voting rights, not less. We shouldn't be suppressing people's voting rights in 2013 and 2014. So we've got a lot of work to do right in my great home state of North Carolina.
Now, I only have a minute left in this segment, but President Obama has been the target of remarkable opposition over the course of his presidency. How much of that is merely political in your eyes, of Republicans versus Democrats, versus being because he's a black president?
I think President Obama is facing opposition because he's been a great president. I think he's faced political opposition from the Republicans purely on partisan basis. But I also believe that he's faced some opposition because he's a great president who happens to be an African-American. Keep in mind, he's not a black president just for black people. President Barack Obama is the president of the United States of all of the citizens. Black, white, Latino, Native American, Asian American, all people should respect the President of the United States without assigning a special category to this president because he happens to be an African American.
Let's take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and WBTV News 3, mornings and evenings. WBTV First Alert Traffic Team provides traffic updates and alternate routes, also on mobile app and at WBTV.com.
And by the law firm of Clements Bernard, serving Charlotte and the Southeast for over 25 years, focusing on intellectual property and business litigation matters. Details at worldpatents.com. Well, you probably have heard that Comcast is trying to buy and take over Time Warner Cable. And if you're a Time Warner Cable customer here in Charlotte, this might be of concern to you. What Comcast's takeover of Time Warner could mean for you and for content and the future of the Internet, because there are different standards at Comcast and Time Warner, which I'm sure Diane will get into in 20 minutes on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is the place to start, and we are coming right back.
We come into your home every Saturday morning, and we try to be the kind of guest that you look forward to. So, we bring you the latest news, conversations with thinkers, writers, singers, comics, economists, public figures, and everyday citizens. And we won't open your refrigerator to see what's inside. I'm Scott Simon. Please join us this weekend on NPR News.
Hear the latest news with Weekend Edition, Saturday and Sunday from 8 till 10 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Dr. Benjamin Chavis, civil rights activist, former head of the NAACP, organizer of the Million Man March, and an alumnus of UNC Charlotte. He is returning to campus on Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. for a screening of Blood Done Sign My Name, which is about the protest that he led in Oxford, North Carolina, back in the... I'm going to forget the year here, Dr. Chavis, 1970, 71, somewhere in there. And that event is free. It's open to the public. He'll be a discussion afterward. And then the following evening, 6:30 to 8:30, he'll be recognized at a reception at the UNC Charlotte City Center campus. And we have information on both events on our website at WFAE.org. Let me go back to President Obama for just a second. There are those who keep saying we need to take our country back. In your mind, what does that mean?
Well, I think those who are opposed to President Barack Obama and say that we need to take our country back, first of all, I think they're being honest. I think they do want to go back to days of Jim Crow. I think they do want to go back to days of having a segregated society. There are some that would like to put black people back in the slave fields. And that's so unfortunate for me even to have to say that, Mike. I think that the majority of Americans don't feel that way. Obviously, President Obama was elected in 2008, and he was reelected in 2012. He curbed North Carolina in 2008. It's so unfortunate he did not curb North Carolina in 2012, which means that the State Democratic Party in North Carolina, we got to do a lot to revive democracy in North Carolina, equal justice in North Carolina, voting rights in North Carolina, health care in North Carolina. We've got so much to do. It's a great state, still has great potential, has the greatest university system, I think, in the country, the UNC system, but not enough equality. And so we have a lot of work to be done. So I think that, yes, there are racist tendencies in 2014 in regards to President Barack Obama, but those tendencies are way in a very small minority. I do not think that the ultra-conservative right-wing Tea Party group represents the views of most Americans.
Are the civil rights struggles of today primarily black and white, or are they economic or class struggles, or are they something else?
Thank you. Very good question. Well, I think the civil rights struggles today are racial. They are also class. Certainly, some of them are also gender in terms of sexual orientation. You know, that's a big battle in North Carolina. Marriage equality, you know, doesn't exist yet in North Carolina. So the thing is, I think that it's intergenerational struggle for justice. And I think that we need the civil rights movement. North Carolina has a growing Latino population. And Latinos are discriminated against in many places across the state of North Carolina in terms of employment, unemployment, in terms of getting their citizenship credentials. Undocumented workers are taken advantage of. So I see the movement that's needed today as being multiracial, multicultural, multilingual.
And that leads to
It's not just a black and white struggle today. It's much more diverse.
And that leads to a problem, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, within the black community, because there is friction between the black community and the Latino community. It goes in both directions. And there is some reluctance on the part of some black leaders, particularly even some of them who were involved in the civil rights movement, against marriage equality. They don't see it as a civil rights issue. So how do you solve those problems?
Keep in mind, the African American is not monolithic. There's a diversity of views. But my position is that you can't be for equality for one group without being for equality for all groups. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s concept of the beloved community was inclusive, not exclusive. And I think there's more solidarity between blacks and Latinos in North Carolina than meets the eye. I predict that in 2014 and 2016, you're going to see a welding of interest between African-Americans, Latinos, progressive whites, Asian. I think we're going to take back North Carolina. I think whenever take back, I mean go back toward being progressive, not go back to the old South. We need the new South. And I think North Carolina needs to lead the new South. And we need to have a revival of democracy in North Carolina.
Let's talk about this. Let's talk about this New South, Old South paradigm.
2 weeks, I'm going to be back in Charlotte talking about democracy rocks and a revival of democracy.
Okay. Let's talk about this New South, Old South paradigm, because one of the things that Charlotte particularly likes to brag about is the fact that early in the civil rights struggle, business people got together with African-American leaders in the community and made a peaceful transition. They integrated the lunch counters, the restaurants, etc., and they did it without fire hoses and dogs and police and riots and things like that, and it led to economic prosperity in this place we call the New South. And what you're seeing, I think, from what I'm hearing you say, is that we're making a trip back in time. We're trying to push back into the old South. And I would guess that it is the new voter ID law that gives you that, and other things, that gives you that feeling that we're sliding back. That law,
absolutely. But keep in mind, the governor of North Carolina is a former mayor of Charlotte.
Yes.
So how can you be a mayor of a progressive city and then become the governor of a reactionary, backward-leaning, voter suppression state?
Well, because the legislature made that decision.
Well, that's not the legislature. Macquarie and the legislature are in the same camp, and he could have vetoed those bills. He did not veto the bills. He signed the bills. So I'm not giving Governor Macquarie a pass. Both in the state Senate, as well as the state representatives, as well as the governor, all three have to be held accountable for the backwardness that North Carolina is now engaging in.
So in your mind, was that voter ID law aimed at what the Republicans say it was aimed at? And their excuse is that everybody gets an ID. Just to drive a car, you need to have an ID. Was it aimed at suppressing the black vote, or was it really aimed at suppressing the big D Democratic vote?
Black vote. It was aimed at suppressing the black vote. It was aimed at suppressing the Latino vote. It was aimed at suppressing young student vote, you know, where students can't vote in the elections and the campuses that they only have to go back home. All of that was designed. And if you look at how the state legislature did the redistricting, it was to disempower those communities that where the demographics have changed. And so, yes, I think Republicans have to be called out. I do think there were racial motives, there were class motives, and also economic motives. I think that
you've left out the political. You know, well, hold it, Dr. Chavis, you left out the political motive. I mean, it seems to me that all those groups that you mentioned—blacks, Latinos, young people—tend to vote Democratic, and the redistricting when the Democrats were in power redistricted as well to make sure that the Democrats got in. Now the Republicans have done so to make sure the Republicans get in.
No,
Isn't that what it is? Republican versus Democrat.
Mike, I just want to know if you go back and look at when the Democrats were in control of the North Carolina legislature, the districts were done on a more bipartisan way, where there were districts also for Republicans and districts for Democrats. But when the Republicans got in, they tried to eliminate all possible chance for Democrats to get elected. No, it was not balanced. I can't say that both the Republicans and Democrats approached redistricting with the same political desire. That's not true. The Republicans were intended to suppress the vote. Democrats were intended to elevate the vote, to make it more possible for more people to come and participate in democracy in North Carolina. And so I think North Carolina is at a crossroads. I think the 2014 election in November is going to be very important, and certainly 2016 is going to be important. I'm hoping that my home state, North Carolina, by the time 2016 comes around, will vote Democratic again, because we've seen that it has not been good for economic prosperity. It has not been good for political justice, the way things are now in Raleigh. Things are too polarized right now.
Do you think that this will be an issue that will galvanize those groups that you mentioned and Democrats at large to mobilize and do something about it in the next election, or do you think it will be too difficult to overcome?
No, I think that's a very good question. The reason why we had such triumph in the 1960s, People's Cup finally ran over and they decided to stand up. I see something similar now. I think the Republicans in Raleigh have pushed too far to the right, and it's going to cause a massive voter turnout. I think you're going to see Republicans get voted out of office in the state representatives, state senators, and in the governor's mansion. Look out. There are people who are going to go to the polls in record numbers in the African-American community, in the Latino community, in the progressive white community, in the student community. All these demographics are going to work together to bring North Carolina back in a more progressive direction, away from the reactionary, negative, Tea Party conservative direction that they have been in over the last couple of years. And it's almost in a shame. North Carolina, things that are going on, national media focus on North Carolina, it's almost people are ashamed of what is going on now in Raleigh. And I'm coming back to my home state myself. I'm not just coming to visit the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. I'm coming back to my hometown in Oxford and find a way to preach in churches, to mobilize communities, and to get out the vote.
It is said that Republicans have been very successful nationally and at the state level in marching in lockstep. They all talk the same talking points, the same message, and they're on point. They have a goal, and they work toward that goal. On the other side of the coin, it's said that getting Democrats to do one thing, it's like trying to herd cats. Everybody's kind of doing their own thing, and you have been. You may be possibly becoming the next head of the North Carolina Democratic Party. So, how would you organize Democrats to fight these fights?
Well, thank you. First of all, I think that Democrats can unify if they're encouraged to unify. I think Democrats should not fight other Democrats. Democrats should be fighting Republicans. Also, I think we have to look at the demographic changes. I think Democrats are not going to win in North Carolina if they keep also looking to the past. We need to look to the future. Well, what are the issues that will bring people out? What are the economic issues? What are the political issues? I think I mentioned this notion of having a revival in North Carolina. I think we need to talk about what does it mean to have an inclusive democracy. Republicans have laid out an exclusive democracy. We want inclusive democracy. That means letting everybody participate, letting everybody benefit from the policies and the legislative actions, not restrictive, but those that are more progressive in terms of inclusiveness. And so I think there is a big difference. I think Democrats have to offer the right alternative. I think too often you find some Democrats in North Carolina who are trying to be like Republicans. You can't win under a Democratic banner, acting like you're a Republican. You're not going to win. You're going to lose more races. So, if I have anything to contribute, and keep in mind, I plan to contribute. I'm not asking for a job in North Carolina. What I'm asking for is a movement to change North Carolina. And I intend to help participate in that movement, help build that movement to bring about change for all of God's people so we can have the quality of life, not for a few, but for everyone.
What would the message be? What? Because today everything is sound bites and snippets of Twitter feeds. So what does the message need to be to galvanize Democrats and convince people who may be on the fence that the way you want to take the state is the right way?
Well, it's the golden rule. I think we have to do unto others as we would do have others do unto us. I think the Democratic Party has to offer a clear alternative to the reactionary, repressive policies and legislative acts by the Republicans. But it has to be genuine. I think people who are marginalized, people who are poor, people who are unemployed, people who don't have adequate health care, have to see that Democrats, once again, will have the courage and the stamina to be progressives. Terry Sanford was a progressive governor in North Carolina. We need more people in the vein of Terry Sanford. Or, you know what? I'm going to see Governor Beverly Perdue, former Governor Beverly Perdue. I wish she would run again. She was a great governor. She was the first female governor that North Carolina has ever had, and one of the greatest. And while we mention this, I think the women of North Carolina need to stand up and speak out. I think if more women would get involved in electoral politics and at the county level, at the municipal level, it would make a great change. Hmm.
You know, you were a force in civil rights and have been ever since the early 60s, and long before Twitter or Facebook or other forms of social media. You didn't have email. You didn't even have cell phones. And all of those things have become a force for showing the world ugly, the ugly belly of conflicts around the world. How would you use social media to get the job done?
Thank you. That's very important. I think President Barack Obama showed in 2008 how social media could be used for progressive advancement of our society and make our democracy more inclusive. I think Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, as well as other uses of the Internet, and particularly for the young generation, Generation Y and the millennials, I think are very much connected to social media. So I think the Democratic Party in North Carolina has to advance its use of technology, has to advance its commitment to social media, not just around election time, Mike. But I'm talking about every day. As you know, social media is in real time. It is not something that you plan to do 6 months in advance and then you execute the plan. No, you have to plan 6 seconds in advance.
Dr. Benjamin Chavis, I'm sorry to tell you we are completely out of time, but I thank you for the hour. Dr. Chavis, former head of the NAACP, organizer of the Million Man March, he will be here. Excuse me, he'll be here on Wednesday for Blood Done Sign My Name.